The boots are behind the kitchen door. Anna lifts them. They're heavier than they should be. She puts her hand into the right boot, and her touch meets cold glass. She draws out a small pot of jam, labelled in Marina's bold, spear-like handwriting, Raspberry Jam, 1940. She reaches into the left boot, and there, too, is a jar. This time, the jam is cloudberry. They are small jars, holding about 400 grams each. How has Marina done it? How has she had the strength to hold these back? Marina!
Bring it here.
We'll have tea with jam. But this is the last of it, Anna. It's all I've got. I hid them away. But now's the time to eat it, because it won't get any worse than this.
What is it, Anna?
Calls Kolya, looking at his sister in the doorway, her face blazing, tears sliding down her cheeks as she holds up the two jars of jam, one in each fist, like a boxer in triumph after the last bloody flesh-pulping round. Jam.
Jam?
They swoop on Marina, clutching her, hugging one another, on their knees and tangled in blanket. Kolya butts his head into Marina's lap.
Jam! Jam! Jam!
He shoves against her. He claws at her clothes.
Jam, Marina! Jam!
Look, raspberry jam! Anna holds it up to the light, and the seeds hang like points of straw in ruby flesh.
And cloudberry, says André. Cloudberry. It's my favourite.
For weeks they haven't dared let such words out of their mouths. They don't dare talk about the food of the past, though they're obsessed by it. Each one of them is locked in silent, separate craving. Little savoury pasties packed with jelly and rich meat. Blini with red caviar and white sour cream. That ice cream I had last summer, and I didn't even finish it. And the ice cream marches across your mind to torment you. Chocolate Eskimo, glistening, rich with cream and sugar, scented with vanilla, sliding across the tongue. Dripping to the ground, half of it wasted, not even thought about. How could you have done that? Raspberry. Cloudberry. They sit between her hands, dark, glistening, packed with sugar, sealed with transparent circles of waxed paper. Look at it. See how clear it is.
Packed with vitamins, says André, examining the jars.
His fingers shake, and the glass chinks lightly.
Antiscorbutic, and so much nicer to take than boiled pine needles.
Many of his patients have scurvy now. In hospital, they're given essence prepared from pine needles. André has obtained the formula and made an evil-tasting liquid which everyone has to take daily. Careful, be careful with those jars. Wait, I'll get saucers and spoons. Anna comes back with four spoons and twists the cap on the cloudberry jam. We'll give Kolya his first. Here. Open your mouth. He tips his head back, opens his mouth wide, and shuts his eyes. His foul, starved breath makes Anna's eyes sting as she carefully places the spoonful of jam in his mouth. Don't swallow it all at once. Taste it. The child's body shudders all over. He holds the jam in his mouth heroically, his eyes watering. Then he gulps it down. He opens his eyes.
More.
In a minute.
More.
She spoons in more. Now wait. It's not good to have too much at once. The adults hold back until the water has boiled and Anna has made tea.
You're a real Stakhanovite, Anna, making all this tea out of nothing.
Yes, I should send a sample to our great leader. Life has become better, life has become more cheerful. And here's the proof of it. Here, Kolya, your tea. And which jam do you want this time? Raspberry or cloudberry? Kolya frowns, savouring choice.
Raspberry. But, Anna, I don't really remember what raspberries taste like. They don't look like I thought.
Here you are. Open your mouth for a spoonful, and then I'll put some on your saucer.
Not too much, says André. He's not used to it. Take it slowly.
There now. Good boy. You've had 2 spoonfuls. Slow down a bit. Smell it first.
Isn't it wonderful? Collier lifts the saucer to his nose and snuffs the fragrance of raspberries trapped in sugar.
I'm going to eat all round the edges, then I'll eat the middle, and then I'll lick the saucer until you can't see anything.
André poises his spoon over Anna's saucer.
Which will you have?
Cloudberry.
Me too.
You could get drunk on such sweetness. The jam syrup slides over tongue, palate, throat. You feel suddenly warm as the sugar hits you, and the touch of acidity that the best cloudberry jam always keeps, and then a sip of scalding tea. You feel your cheeks flushing. Surely, for a moment, you look like yourself again as you scrape up the last quarter spoonful. You are young again, with smooth, full flesh. You wipe the saucer clean with your finger and suck it.
Cloudberries remind me of home, says André. And blackberries, too. When blackberries are ripe in hot sun, they already smell like jam.
But you don't have hot sun in Siberia.
Of course we have. No one has a summer like ours.
The sun comes down to the earth, where we are. It's not like your high-up Petersburg sun. And it really burns. We roll around in it, just as we roll in the snow in winter time.
You don't know anything about it, Anna, until you've been there. But I'll show you. Just wait.
We'll take bread and goat's cheese and a berry pail. Even in winter you can find berries under the snow if you know where to look. The snow lies deep on them. There's an ice crust, and when you break through it, there's fine, soft snow like powder. You have to dig down, but lightly, with your fingers, so that you don't crush the berries. When the snow's cleared away, the bushes spring up, and the berries are there, coated in ice. The ice preserves them. You can walk all day out there and feel better than you did when you set out.
Yes, goat's cheese.
Do you think we could have another spoonful, Marina, or should we save it? Marina seems not to hear the question. She's turning her saucer round in her hand, but not eating it. Marina, aren't you going to eat yours? You must eat.
Not now. I'll drink my tea.
But you eat. Take another spoonful.
Collier, have a little bit of mine and see if you remember what cloudberries taste like.
You know what this reminds me of?
What?
Easter.
Easter? Why?
Oh, you're too young, all of you, to remember.
We'd fast for 6 weeks. Even in the theatre we'd fast when I was 20 or 21. And then suddenly you'd know that things were changing. It was exactly the feeling that you get when the wind changes direction and begins to blow from the southwest.
And then Holy Week came. Holy Thursday was the day I loved most, when we'd boil onion skins and dip our eggs in the water to colour them. Oh, there was such an atmosphere. It grew day by day, mounting up until you knew things couldn't possibly go on like this. And down by the river you could already hear water running strongly under the ice. And the surface of the ice had that grainy look it doesn't have at any other time, except just before it melts.
We'd go to confession. All of us, even those who weren't really believers. Even if you didn't really believe, you'd feel sure that something had happened. It was like winter lifting from your soul. And you would notice everything. Little children running about with red cheeks, fresh as bread. And the way ice stayed thick and dirty in the lee of walls, where the sun didn't come. I had a pair of black suede boots with little heels, and I remember picking my way to the theatre and watching the little square tips of the boots, and thinking how perfect they were, and how much I liked the noise of my heels tapping on the pavement. Suddenly we were all eager to help one another, even those of us who were rivals for parts. Of course it didn't last. And when Sunday came, everyone would greet you, and you'd greet everyone, "Christ is risen!" And they'd answer, "He is risen indeed."
In our house, when I was growing up, they always served cloudberry jam with the Pashka on Easter Day.
Marina, eat it, please.
I'll eat it later. I'm so tired, I've got to sleep now.
Just a little. Here, smell it.
Anna holds the spoon to Marina's mouth. Marina's mouth wrinkles, opens a little, then closes.
With all her heart, Anna wants Marina to swallow and to eat her share. But with something else, which doesn't feel like her heart at all, she reasons, if Marina doesn't eat, there will be more for Kolya. And it's not as if I haven't tried to make her.
Don't, Anna. I want to lie down. I'm really not hungry.
They help her into bed and cover her with the stove-warmed blanket. Her eyes close at once and she sinks away from them into sleep.
Now, Kolya, let's get you settled on the sofa.
Kolya curls up in his nest with the chessboard and paper pieces.
And then the bad horse comes up and tries to swallow all the people, but they don't let him. They run away and their friends help them.
It's a bad sign, says Andrei quietly.
What? But he's looking so much better. More energy.
Not Kolya.
Marina. Not that she didn't eat, but that she's not hungry. It's a recognized stage in the physiology of starvation.
And in spite of himself, and for all his warm sympathy towards Marina, Andrei can't help a faint gleam of satisfaction crossing his face at his accurate, professional diagnosis. He'd understood her condition, right down to the torrent of memory she'd let loose. That was all part of it, too. He knows what is happening, and he has the right words to describe it. That was what his professor said 2 days ago. You've already experienced what very few doctors ever experience. If you live, you'll become a good doctor. And he had glowed with it. Yes, in the frozen corridor where corpses lay like wood, he had been elated. But it's Marina he's talking about. She's always scared him a bit. But she's part of this home, where in weeks they've grown into one another more closely than a family of 40 years. It's the place where Anna bends over Kolya, with her lips moving as he eats, where Marina and Anna pass a sliver of scented soap between them. It's a place of books, drawings, ancient rugs that are loved all the more because they're worn out, and of meticulous sharing out of soup and cereal into equal portions, which are then sabotaged by both women's determination to give Kolya that featherweight on the scales which may add up to his life. It's where Anna sets out for her hours of queuing in savage cold, where she jots down for him items of news she's heard on Radio Leningrad, because otherwise she'll have forgotten them by the time he gets home. She worries about not being able to remember things, but he tells her that it's only a temporary symptom. Her diet is lacking in important minerals and vitamins, he tells her solemnly, and they both laugh. But he knows that she's relieved. And then she presents him with an insulating lining for his boots, which she's made out of the felt underside of her father's desk blotter. He should not have spoken of Marina like that, as if he were on a ward round and she were any anonymous patient. Quickly, to blot out his words, he says,
we mustn't let her sleep too long. We must rouse her in not less than an hour's time and feed her. And we must keep checking her temperature.
She's exhausted, that's all, says Anna.
I don't know how long she was sitting in that room.
No,
he frowns, lost in his own thoughts.
We shouldn't have let her go on talking like that. She's too weak.
She wanted to.
Yes, people get like that. The past is clearer to them than the present. They have to speak about it. And then they stop talking. And you know they aren't remembering any more. They've gone back there.
And the horse stamps his feet so hard that all the people are frightened and they hide in their houses, right back here where the horse can't get at them.
Anna, would you do that?
Do what? She asks, to gain time, because she thinks she's already understood the question.
If I were dead, and there was nothing you could do for me any more, would you still go and sit with me?
We're not like them, Andrei.
I know we're not.
We've had different lives, and they were born in such different times. They try to belong to the present, but they can't.
They loved one another,
She loved him. I'm not so sure about my father. Perhaps he loved the fact that she loved him.
But she kept on.
Yes. And she won't stop. She'll go on until she dies, too.
Why do you say that?
It's true.
You sound so cold, Anna.
I'm not cold. It's only that I don't believe in sacrificing yourself when the sacrifice doesn't benefit anyone.
It's what she wants.
I can see that.
So you wouldn't sit beside me?
Andrei, you're asking me something that doesn't make any sense. I'm not Marina. I've got Kolya to think of.
I know you have. It's not that I don't understand that.
It's just I know you wish that I hadn't got him. You want us to start together from nothing, together, with nothing to think about but each other. I don't blame you.
Elizaveta Antonovna at the nursery always used to get angry about the way I was with Kolya.
Really, Anna Mikhailovna, anyone would think that child was your own son. Don't you realise what a bad impression you're making? She didn't think any upstanding Soviet citizen would look twice at me. My class origins, for a start, and then a child in tow. Well, maybe she was right.
How can you say that? You know that isn't what I mean. I'm talking about you, not about other people.
Yes. Kolya's voice has faded to a murmur. He's tired, too, after the burst of energy that the jam has given him. He lies back on the sofa cushions, his face wiped clean of mood, his eyes unfocused, staring at the paper strips that crisscross the window. His lips move.
Kolya, what are you talking about?
I'm talking to my little horse. I'm telling him to be brave because the big horse has hurt his head. He kicked him.
That wasn't nice.
No, you shouldn't kick people. Anna, is Marina dead?
No, of course not. What made you think that?
Only she looks dead.
She's sleeping. She's very tired.
Like Daddy.
He's dead, Kolya.
I know. But he was tired as well.
You remember you said goodbye to him?
Of course I remember. I'm not a baby. Anna, do a lot of people always die?
No, not like this. I told you it's because of the war. Usually people don't die until they get old.
Oh, I forgot you told me that.
I'll play a game of chess with you, Kolya, says Andrei, and then I've got to go.
To the hospital?
Yes, to the hospital.
Andrei?
What?
Are we... you know, like Daddy and Marina?
You mean, are we going to die?
Kolya presses his lips together and nods.
No, says Andrei. We're not going to die. Not you and me and Anna. We're going to live.
Kolya's lips purse in an exaggeratedly nonchalant, soundless whistle.
It's only that I wasn't sure, so I wanted to know, he explains.
Andrei sets out the paper chess pieces, going over their positions with Kolya.
Now you show me, Kolya, where your king goes and where your queen goes.
They play for 10 minutes or so, in the guttering candlelight. Anna watches without speaking. Soon she will have to move, but not just yet. She has found a leather manicure case which belonged to her father. He must have forgotten about it because it was in the pocket of his dressing gown. It is pigskin, she thinks. She has emptied out scissors, clippers and emery board and removed the metal fastenings. Now she must fetch water and put the manicure case on the stove to make broth from it. It will take a long time before the pigskin softens, but it will be worthwhile. There'll be nourishment in it. They'll drink the broth, and Kolya can chew the pigskin. Andrei glances up. The angle of candlelight flushes his hollow, old man's face with youth. He smiles at her. Although his eyes are only shadows in this light, she knows their exact colour. They are blue-black, like the waters of Lake Baikal. Andrei says that Lake Baikal is 6 miles deep, No one knows what is down there, though they say that Baikal sturgeon can live for 300 years. The waters of the lake are pure and life-giving. Even the stones from its shores bring luck. How much you could hide in water 6 miles deep. But Andre's eyes don't conceal anything from her in their depths. However deep she goes, there is still love, so complete and undistorted that it frightens her. She is used to living with tangled people, and their tangled stories. But Andre isn't like that. I love you. I want to be with you. Come with me. She hasn't grown up with such words. Maybe that was why she turned him away when he asked his question. Maybe he frightens her just a little, because he's at ease in such deep waters. He is going to make her join him there. And he asks her questions no one has ever asked before. So you wouldn't sit beside me.
You look so nice, she says now. You and Kolya.
Andre smiles, without answering.
Yes, I would, she goes on, so quietly that he can't possibly hear her.
But he does. What would you do?
Sit with you.
Outside, the wind whines. It brings snow with it, which will swallow up Andre as soon as he steps out of the apartment building's shelter. It will buffet him, blind him, cover his cap and his eyelashes. It will sting his eyes with particles of ice. He will stumble on, hugging walls and feeling for the edge of the pavement with his cherrywood stick. It's a blizzard in which anyone could be forgiven for dying.
Anna, when's Andre coming back?
Not until tomorrow. I've already told you, so don't keep on asking. He's doing the night shift.
He's been gone ages.
She blows out the candle and lifts a corner of the blackout. But there's nothing to see.
Is it still snowing, Anna?
Yes, it's still snowing.
Go to sleep.
In the German lines, sentries stamp their feet. Christmas is over, and here's a new year of filthy Russian weather. We should have been halfway to China by now. Soon we'll be. A few more weeks ought to do it. In Leningrad, a tank rolls down towards the Moscow gates on its way to the front line. Its 30 tons of steel rock and grind over the tramway. From city to battle is no distance at all. By the Baltic shores the sea is frozen too, and snow lies so thickly on it that it's impossible to tell where the sea ends and the land begins. Snow falls between the birches and onto the frozen Neva. It covers the rubble of shelled apartments and the burned-out farmyard where Mikhail bought his eggs. It drifts into abandoned, looted villages, hiding shallow graves. 2 armies stare through the blizzard, straining for enemy movement. All planes are grounded, and there will be no bombing tonight. Over the ice road, the road of life, lorries move slowly forward from control post to control post. The ice is thickening every day as winter grips more deeply. The ice road is beginning to do its job. Vasya Sokolov never expected to end up driving lorries over the ice road, but that's where they've posted him, and that's what he's doing. He knows he's lucky. He's kept hold of the Sokolov luck. He hasn't ended up on the front line. This is his 2nd crossing of the day, loaded up with flour and ammunition. He's going to be several barrels above plan if he manages a 3rd crossing.
Comrades, every extra bag of flour you carry will save 100 Leningrad children from starvation.
Yeah, but you can't think like that. Not all the time. Not when there are delays and the bags of flour sit on the back, getting nowhere. This lorry's a bastard, anyway. Something's been wrong with the steering all week. Vasya smashes his hand down on the steering wheel. Don't play tricks with me, you fucker. People are getting shot for less. The lorry groans and heaves itself on over the rutted ice, slipping and sliding. Still dragging to the left. How far back was that repair station? 200 meters? I could head back there. No. Go on, you bastard. Don't fuck with me.
The lorry mounts a ridge of ice. Its wheels spin, then catch. The engine labours. At that moment, the lorry's juddering loosens a connection. The electrical spark can't quite jump across. The engine stops. Vasya knows immediately what the problem is. It's happened before. All he has to do is get the hood open and restore the connection. Vasya's got a real feel for engines. And he's done a maintenance course. It won't take him 5 minutes to get this bastard going again. At least for long enough to push on to the next control post.
It's very quiet. Snow sifts across the windscreen while Vasya fastens his ear flaps and reaches down for the screwdriver. He opens the door and the wind hits him. A wind straight from the north, stinging with snow. 30 below, 50 with this wind. It's like being skinned. A shocked sound comes out of Vasya's throat. He shuts his mouth and feels his way round to the front of the lorry, keeping one hand on the metal. In this whiteout, he could be 5 metres from the lorry and lost for good. The hood creaks open. He props it and clambers up to peer inside, but snow's falling so thickly he can't see the wiring. He wipes his face and starts again. It's not the same connection. He tugs gently, but these wires are secure. Right, try again. Snow spits and melts on the warm metal. There it is. The wire's snapped, and he can't see the end of it. It's frayed now, and too short. It won't reconnect. Still, that doesn't matter. All he needs is another piece of wire, and he's got some back in the cab. No problem. Now he knows where the problem is. He feels his way back to the cab, gasping with the punch of the wind, climbs up and looks for his wire. Nothing. Some bastard's nicked it. No, it was him. He used the wire yesterday and forgot to replace it. Vasya's face darkens, but he doesn't do anything, doesn't punch the steering wheel this time. Got to think of something quick. Any piece of metal will do. Wire securing the crates in the back, maybe. A hair grip would do. What if he'd had a girl in the cab and her hair grip fell out when they were doing it and he found it now, closed his hand on it just the right length? He could get the job done in no time. Round the back. Untie the straps over his load. Get a look at those crates. Suddenly, he thinks he hears an engine. Coming closer, someone behind him, one of the boys, maybe Ugly Yuri or Mitya. "Here, mate!" Vasya shouts. "I'm over here!" And he's let go of the straps. He's waving his arms. He's stepped away from the lorry towards the engine noise. He'd never have done it if it hadn't been for the wind knifing up his brain. He's on his own. He's left his load. People get shot for less. He reaches out, sweeping about him with his arms. Snow that way. Is that the way the engine noise came? He can't hear it now. The wind so loud, beating into his skull. Snow this way. He takes another step, reaching out for metal. Snow falls into his arms. His sacks of flour with the stamps on them. Food for Leningrad. He won't be above plan if he doesn't get a move on. Get back to the lorry, find a piece of wire, make the connection, start the engine. But he can't find it. His lorry won't tell him where it is. It stays quiet, playing hidey in the snow.
"Where are you, you fucker?" shouts Vasya Sokolov. The wind drives. The snow pours onto him. He puts up his hands to shield his eyes, but the snow stings its way into them. Now he doesn't know where he is. A hair grip. That's all he wants. Like little girls wear to keep their hair back. They're always losing them, and then their hair flops over their faces.
"Vasya? Vasya, can you see my hair grip? It's fallen in the water. I've got to find it."
Who said that?
Andrei stops in the shelter of an apartment doorway. He knows where he is. Straight on, third turning on the right, and down to the hospital. He can find his way, even in this whiteout. Perhaps he could let himself rest for a few minutes. If he kicks the snow off these steps and sits down just for a little while, it will be quite easy to lever himself up again. He's got the stick to help him. He's used to worse blizzards than this, and he knows what to do. He doesn't come from Irkutsk for nothing. It's peaceful here.
in this little doorway, which is fantastically hung with icicles. Here, there's time to think. Imagine little Kolya asking if we were going to die, just as if he were asking about a trip to the zoo. And I said no. But in the hospital there'll be more patients than ever. Children with shiny skin stretched over swollen bellies. Old men dead in corridors. Fever, dysentery, dystrophy, frostbite, failing eyesight, suppurating gums, tuberculosis, pneumonia. Most of them will die. But before they do, they need a doctor there to look carefully into their eyes and mouths and ears, to sound their chests, to take their pulse and offer water and such drugs as we have. They must have what there is. There must be someone who is still on his feet to take the baby out of the arms of its dying mother and tell her, "It's all right, we'll take care of him." We are men, not beasts. Andrei heaves himself up. As he emerges from the shelter of the doorway, a blast of wind hurls snow into his face. He blinks, hunches his head between his shoulders to protect it, grips the cherry wood stick, and walks into the wind. Chapter 30. It is May. The sky is a high, clear blue, and although there are a few white clouds floating at the horizon towards the Gulf of Finland, they never cross the sun or dim the radiance of summer light. In streets, in parks, on bridges and along the water, people are strolling. They blink in the bright sunlight. They are thin, marked by sickness and weakness. Some lean on sticks, although they are young. They keep away from the side of the street, which is signed as the most dangerous in case of shelling, even when this means that they must walk in shadow. Leningrad is still under siege. But there is food. These are people who have eaten this morning, and will eat again tonight. They're hungry, they're underfed, but they're not starving any more. Trams are running, electricity is flowing. In January, the ice road began to fulfil its promise. All through the rest of the winter, and until the ice thawed, it brought in food and fuel. Most of those who are still living will now live. There's a new military commander in charge, an artillery specialist. Govorov, he's called. "Let's hope he gets our guns talking a bit louder," people say, when they learn their new commander's name. He's a real strategist. When it comes to shelling the German positions, he's a tiger, doesn't wait for their guns to open up, but belts into their artillery first. Well, that's clear enough. Anyone can see the sense of that, provided you've got the guns to do it. And Govorov seems to have the knack of getting the guns. But on the ground, he's more of a puzzle. His line seems to be that sometimes you have to fall back in order to attack. But you wouldn't think there was anywhere to fall back to, what with the Germans so close, shelling us from the Pulkovo Heights, making camp in the Peterhof Palace. Soldiers on the front line say they can hear the Germans yelling sometimes, in what they think is Russian. "All Ruskis kaput! Stalin kaput! Leningrad kaput!" Funny dear, them bawling away about you-know-who like that. Govorov's already pulled the 86th back from Nevskaya Dubrovka, our foothold on the other side of the Neva, from which, maybe one day, we could have pushed outward deep into German flesh. Nevskaya Dubrovka had already used up so many lives. Surely we should never have abandoned it. Surely you've got no choice but to keep on paying for a piece of land once it's already cost you so much in blood. You'd have thought Govorov would have held on to it, whatever happened. Doesn't he know how many men have coughed up their guts into that soil and laid down their bones for the next man to walk on as if they were building Petersburg all over again? But what does Govorov care about that? He's been airlifted in, another high up, with his orders straight from God.
Govorov's all right. Govorov knows what he's up to. You'll see, he's got a plan, says the infantry of the 86th.
Who might have had enough of being the symbol of Leningrad's heroic resistance. The shelling is not so bad today. The sheer, sharp quality of light bathes everyone and reveals everything. These are the survivors emerging from their winter of starvation. Lips are pale and cracked, faces drawn into triangles, hair dry and dusty. The siege has gutted them. It's not half over yet, or even a quarter over. The radio keeps telling them to brace themselves, go forward and continue their heroic resistance. The Germans are still advancing deep into Russia. Intelligence suggests that a new German offensive on Leningrad is planned, and meanwhile the blockade continues to grip. But there are supplies in hand now. Even now that the ice has gone, there'll be shipping to transport food and ammunition into the city. Pavlov is no longer walking a bare wire. He's got figures to add to his columns now. Already it's vanished, the terror of nothingness that gripped Leningrad that winter. That winter. To speak of it, or not to speak, that's the question. It's too close, too vast, like an immense fall you have only just not fallen. Behind, there are the sheer, icy sides of the pit that might have swallowed you. The dead are gone from streets and houses. Heaps of snow and filth have been cleared. The Neva sparkles blue, where women crawled across wastelands of ice with buckets of water that smelled of corpses. There's another factor that doubles the survival chances of those who have survived so far. There are fewer mouths to feed now. No one speaks of it, but the truth is that Leningrad's population is down to half of what it was. Of course, they've evacuated thousands over the ice road. Hundreds of thousands, people say to one another. And this is true. They know, and do not say, how many more death has taken. From every row of wooden houses, from every apartment building, shop, museum, library, factory, hospital, orphanage, school, the corpses of winter have now been removed, leaving empty, sunlit apartments, unswept doorsteps, classes without their teachers, teachers with classes of 10 children instead of 30, empty seats at library desks, shops that don't open, poems that will not be written, operations that will fail to be performed, and little boats that will not, this season, be uncovered, repainted, and launched from shallow, sandy shores onto the waters of the Baltic. The sun shines. Everything's possible now that the sun is here, warming flesh and drawing dandelions and nettles out of waste ground. As long as you can still walk, no matter how slowly, and pause from time to time to hold up your face to the sun and let a haze of glowing red soak through your eyelids, everything is still possible. Radio Leningrad advises mothers to expose their children's skin to the sun because it's a valuable source of vitamins. It seems impossible, but children are still being born. An old couple shuffles into the sunlight. Now that they are close, you can see that they are in fact young. He wears a cap which sits oddly on his huge, exposed skull. She wears a headscarf with a pattern of roses. They walk in step, supporting each other. "Look," says Anna. "Isn't that Zina and Fedya?"
"I don't think I know him."
"He's changed."
"Yes, he must have been ill. He's wearing slippers on swollen feet, and Zina's the one doing the supporting, not him."
"Zina," she calls uncertainly. "Is that you, Anna?"
"Yes, it's me."
"Forgive me. It's only that everyone looks so different."
"How are you?"
"We're alive. I thought I should lose Fedya as well, but look, here he is."
And here he is. His powerful body has disappeared. Skin stretches like paper over his nose and jaw, but his legs and feet are swollen. His thick, fair hair has fallen out.
"Yes, he's been very ill. He's been in hospital. Anybody else would have died,
but not him."
"You weren't going to let it happen, were you, Fedya?"
She covers his hand with her own. Her smile is proud, tender, maternal. He's not only lived, but he's brought her back to life.
Without his illness, she would have followed Vanka.
"I like your scarf," says Anna.
"I know, it's pretty, isn't it? I love roses. When all this is over, Fedger's going to buy me some real roses, aren't you, Fedger?"
He nods, but doesn't speak. The effort of standing is enough for him.
"And with you?" asks Sina, delicately. "How are things?"
"This is how you put it these days. You never ask directly. My father died, and Marina Petrovna died."
Zina puts her hand on Anna's arm.
"But your little one?"
"He's over there."
Anna points down the sunlit street, where two little boys are playing by a wall. They are crouched down with their heads close together, and they have wiped from their minds everything in the world but their game.
"It's nice for him to have someone to play with," says Anna.
"So he lived," says Zina.
"Yes."
They stand in a silent group. Winter is over, and the dead are still dead, because it was never true that they had only died for the duration. The mounds of bodies are being buried as fast as the authorities can handle them. More than 100,000 were buried last month. The streets are quiet, and people walk in little groups, not crowds. They say 1 million have died, but the figures are only approximate. The bird-like cheepings of Kolya and the other child suddenly darken.
"It's my turn to attack." "No, it isn't. It is. You're a liar. Give me back my truck, then. I'm not going to play with you any more."
A mother appears in the entrance to the apartment house, shading her eyes.
"Now that's enough. Can't you ever play for 5 minutes without arguing, Grisha? You've been moaning about having no one to play with for long enough."
She looks up the street, catches Anna's eye, shrugs, and calls across.
"Kids, they never give you 5 minutes peace, do they? Kolya, if you don't want to play, then don't play. But if you're playing, play nicely."
The children stare up at her with their sharpened faces. They know what grown-ups can do and what they can't do. Out they pour, the streams of banality that have made up Anna's life for years. Socialization, Elizaveta Antonovna calls it, though she does very little of it herself. But although the nursery has reopened, Elizaveta Antonovna's not back from Moscow yet. She's too important where she is. There will be a new director, but so far one hasn't been appointed. It's hard to find anyone.
"Are you going to evacuate your Kolya, now that there's the chance?" asks Sina.
"No, he stays with us. Andrei's got us a little plot of land behind the hospital, and we've planted potatoes and cabbages."
"We must be getting on," says Sina. There was something she wanted to say to Fedya, Anna remembers. Something she'd forgotten.
But she can't remember it now.
She hopes Andrei's right when he says it's lack of vitamins that makes her forget so much. Her brain only seems able to hold one idea at a time.
"Fyodor Dmitrievich." His eyes turn to her, dull with sickness.
"Of course, that was it. When they last faced one another in the snow, when he was bringing home the wood on his sledge. After Vanka died."
She almost steps back as it rises up and possesses her. The snowy street, the houses packed with dead, the man who put the steel tip of his boot by her head. It isn't the past. It isn't history, and it never will be.
But what is it, then? Don't think of all that now. Here's Fedya.
Not handsome any more. Looking at her without curiosity.
She'd told him a line from that Pushkin poem.
"We'll find them space in Russian earth," she'd said.
And there'd been a flash of understanding between them, as if at last they knew they were the same kind, fighting the same thing.
He'd answered, "You're right there. We'll bury them."
But it was only later that she'd remembered the rest of the lines.
"Listen," she says, "I remember it all now. The whole poem.
Because we made our earth swallow the juggernaut which crushed nation after nation, and with our blood redeemed the freedom, honour, and peace of Europe."
Fedya still doesn't speak.
Perhaps a shade of lightness crosses his face.
On the landing, Fedya, with his towel slapping his bare shoulder, in singlet and trousers, pushing into the bathroom first. A real Leningrad boy, a boy of the courtyard, grey eyes, muscled shoulders, and thick, fair hair.
"Come away now,"
says Zina to her husband. "You wear yourself out standing here. There's nothing more tiring than standing. You know what, Anna? My Fedger was defending the works right up to the day they took him off to the hospital. They had to stop him. He wouldn't stop himself. He ought to get a medal." "Yes, he ought," says Anna. The May sunlight is piercing her eyes and making them sting. Zina's right. Standing here like this, talking to old friends, is the most exhausting thing of all. Anna and Andrei watch as the couple shuffles away.
"Kidney disease," says Andrei.
"You can't know that."
"No," he agrees, "you're right. I can't be sure."
They call Kolya to them and walk on. "Look, dandelions," says Anna, and kneels to grub up a handful of leaves. "Keep a lookout for more, Kolya. You're closer to the ground than I am." He runs off to scavenge between stones while she examines the new green leaves. This colour won't last. As the sun grows stronger, so these leaves will darken and toughen. The indented pattern is cut into the leaves like tooth marks, just the same as every other year. She lifts a leaf to her lips and nibbles it.
"Full of vitamin C," says Andrei. "And I think there may be useful traces of folic acid as well.
If we find any more, I'll prepare a salad. We've got enough oil to coat the leaves."
"Yes, a salad's better than soup. It preserves the nutrients."
"Andrei, will you please stop talking like that?" He smiles at her. She's wearing that green dress again. Her favourite dress. She put it on so carefully, patting the folds into place before drawing the belt tight around her waist, and then loosening it again. It looked better loose. He could see her thinking that. She was still very thin. When she stood naked, he saw her ribs rise and fall with the quick pants of her breath. She got out of breath so easily, and her breasts were shallow. She felt him looking and quickly huddled on her dress. But the image of her hung on his mind like a photograph, her skin winter pale, her pelvic bone showing, her knees startlingly bony and protuberant. When she had the dress on, she turned and looked at him, and smiled uncertainly. "It's the first time I've worn it this year. Does it look all right?" Her thin, pale arms hung down from the two large sleeves of the dress. She made a gesture with her arms, as if offering up what she was to him. "I know I look terrible." "No, you don't look terrible. It's no good saying that, Andrei. I've got a mirror."
"Well, I look just the same."
"Do you think we're ever going to be ourselves again?" "Oh, look at my hair. Every time I comb it, more falls out. It'll grow. All you need is protein. And minerals."
"I know that."
He touched her upper arms, where a fine down of hair caught the light falling through the window.
Another sign of malnutrition. And his own hands looked enormous, with lumps of bony knuckles sticking out and great raw wrist bones. Who would want to be touched with such hands?
But Anna closed her eyes and sighed and leaned towards him, and although his hands shamed him, he felt them tightening on her. All winter they had slept cupped into one another and felt nothing. He pulled her closer. She put her lips on his, dry and searching. They kissed.
After a while he said,
"You taste different."
"I know. My breath doesn't stink any more."
It was true. The graveyard smell of starvation had left them. Her lips were dry, but not cracked. It must have been the nettle soup she'd been making, and the increase in the rations.
The inside of her mouth was moist. They tasted each other again, exploring, her thin body pressing against his through the folds of her green dress and the folds of the shirt that hung on him. Their bones were sharp, but they pressed closer. She moved a little, fitting him to herself.
"Yes, you taste right," she said. "You taste of yourself again."
Anna has collected a fat bunch of dandelion leaves. Ahead of them, Kolya runs to a heap of rubble where a wall has collapsed under shelling.
Nettles are sprouting, and dandelions, and tufts of new grass. Kolya darts here and there, picking leaves.
There are loads here, Anna. Millions!
He waves a bunch of leaves at her, then kneels to grub up more. Anna looks down at the dandelion leaves in her hand. Sun glistens on them. They're so fresh that they look as if they're still unfolding. Anna eats another leaf. The taste is sharp and peppery. The taste of life and not of death. Marina and Mikhail lay side by side for a while. Now, although they lie in the same grave, they share it with thousands of other Leningraders. Perhaps, by accident, they were flung together and they touch, as Marina would have wished. More likely, they are quite separate. Already new grass is furring the mound of the mass grave where they lie, just as frost furred their bodies in the room where Anna and Andrei laid them side by side, touching, on Mikhail's bed. Anna could not bring herself to lay Marina on the floor. She looked at them, side by side, their noses pointing at the ceiling, and then she shut the door. She didn't believe that they were together. Their grave will be much visited. 15 years later, work will begin on a memorial to the victims of the Leningrad blockade. Generations of Leningraders will come here, to Piskarevsky Cemetery. They'll stand for a while, stare at the eternal flame, read the poem engraved on the memorial stone, and lay flowers. In the earth, slowly, imperceptibly, separately, the flesh of Marina and Mikhail will part from its bones and dissolve into the flesh of all those other Leningraders who died of hunger in silent, frigid rooms. The mummified babies, who barely had time to emerge into the light before they were snuffed out. The students who walked arm in arm through the summer gardens eating Eskimo ice cream. The professors, the refugee peasants who fled to Leningrad pushing their possessions in handcarts, hoping to save their lives. The orchestra members who kept on practicing in fingerless gloves as the temperature in their rehearsal rooms sunk beyond zero. Writers, lathe turners, museum curators, engineers, street cleaners, school children. There are so many of them. Such an unearthly number that the mind also dissolves at the thought of it. The memorial stone will swear that they will never be forgotten, and this may be true. Is that enough for them, those ones under the grass? They're Leningraders, after all. They know the score. Leningraders will always be aware that stones can be lifted. Statues can be felled, names changed, engraved words erased overnight. Invaders can come again. There's no use relying too much on a memory that's only set in stone. In another part of the city, a red-haired woman with strong, bared, freckled arms is digging. Rows of young cabbages are being planted out where the park's turf has been removed. Every square metre of open land in the city must be prepared for food production against a second winter of siege. The beets are already in, and the potatoes. The woman bends forward, thrusts her spade deep into the earth, loosens it with a practised jerk of her foot, and brings up the heavy spadeful. It's city earth, used to growing grass and flowers, but it has the same smell as earth in spring everywhere. It is sour, fermenting, full of promise. It crumbles easily after the deep frosts of the winter. Yevgenia moves sideways and drives her spade in again. A couple of men in uniform stop to watch her. The sun is behind her, and it turns her red hair into a blazing halo. She's taken off her headscarf and rolled her sleeves up above her elbows. Yevgenia has always liked the feeling of sun on her bare skin. The men watch Yevgenia. Her clumsy jacket and trousers hide her body, but they can tell she's just the kind of woman they fancy. They can picture the strong socket of her waist, bent at work, her hips, her breasts. They admire the strength of her white arms. Not too skinny, either. She's managed to keep a bit of flesh on her.
"She looks as if she could carry on like that forever," says one of them.
"Yes, she's a real worker, that one." Yevgenia's spade slices cleanly into the earth. Up comes another spadeful, with the moisture of spring still on it, making it glisten like chocolate. Now the sun and rain will sweeten it. The young cabbages will spread their roots and drive deep, fattening themselves on the endless sunshine of white nights. These cabbages will have to work hard. They must pump themselves full of life in the brief, dazzling northern summer before the frost comes round again and turns their stalks to blackened slime. A patch of sweat spreads between Yevgenia's shoulder blades, and she wipes her face, streaking it with fresh earth. She glances behind her, but the men have moved on. She had the feeling that someone was watching her, and she doesn't like that. Four more rows, and then she'll rest. Or perhaps she'll carry on a little longer. After all, you don't get many days like this. Three people stroll along the embankment, close to Lieutenant Schmidt's bridge. The late sun strikes towards them, bouncing off the water so that they squint and shield their eyes. The man and woman walk close, touching at shoulder, hip, and thigh. They are enlaced, lazy, only just keeping an eye on the little one scooting along the curb ahead of them. Is the child a girl or a boy? The three of them are far off, and it's hard to tell. Suddenly they move into a bar of light reflecting up from the water. Broken, shivering pieces of light run up and down their bodies. They look as if they are dancing. They are mother, father, and child, out for a walk on this beautiful May afternoon, as Leningrad settles like a swan on the calmest of waters. But, of course, they are not. Нет. Вьес я не умру. No, I shall not wholly die. Alexander Pushkin. That is the end of The Siege. It was written by Helen Dunmore and read by Julie Bond.
This has been an ISIS audiobooks presentation. For further details of our extensive catalogue of audiobooks on cassette, CD and MP3, please call our free phone number 0800 731 5637.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.